last item on our afternoon agenda is number 16, the Tribal Hunting Overview. This is a briefing. Nate Pamplin, our Assistant Director for the Wildlife Program, is here to give us information on tribal hunting.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Director Anderson. My name is Nate Pamplin. I'm the Assistant Director of the Wildlife Program. And this afternoon, I wanted to provide just a general overview of tribal hunting in Washington. I'll start with just a primer on interpreting treaties, talk about the authorities of tribal governments, review the state Supreme Court case law as it relates to interpreting the treaty right. I'll go through some of the key elements of hunting agreements that we have between the department and tribes. I'll walk through how we've been addressing some of the traditional hunting area assertions by tribes and some draft procedural guidelines that we've been using for the past 4 or 5 years. We'll start with really at the 101 level. And, you know, when Governor Stevens was negotiating treaties with Washington tribes, the language was remarkably similar across the eight different treaties that were signed for the territory of Washington. And this language, the right of taking fish at usual and custom grounds and stations, in common with citizens of the territory, has received just a tremendous amount of attention in the federal courts going back to well over a 109-year history, going all the way back to U.S. v. Winans in 1905. While the phrase, the privilege of hunting on open and unclaimed lands, has received less attention in federal court, I'll walk through some of the state court examples, but, you know, this phrase, you know, what's the definition of right? What's the definition of fish? Where are UNAs? What does it mean to be in common with? All of those have received just various levels of attention in different sub-proceedings to try to get at that answer. Well, again, the privilege of hunting hasn't had as much assistance from the courts in terms of in helping us understand what that means. But in general, when we look at how to interpret treaty rights, it's important to know that, first off, treaties are contracts between two sovereigns. And so under the U.S. Constitution, treaties are considered the supreme law of the land. And essentially, the treaties will preempt state law unless there's a conservation necessity. And I'll walk through a state Supreme Court case that further fleshes that out on the wildlife side. It's important to keep in mind that treaty fishing and hunting rights belong to tribes, not to individual tribal members. It's a responsibility for the tribal government to promulgate regulations that regulate these off-reservation hunting and fishing activities for their membership. And in general, when courts interpret ambiguities in the treaty language, they tend to tilt the scales towards favoring the tribes. Thinking about back in the time when the treaties were being negotiated, it was in essentially a trading jargon. Some of the subtle nuances of the words would not have been recognized by the individuals that were negotiating the treaty at the time. Certainly, very different than what we might interpret the differences, for instance, in the word right and privilege 150 years later. And finally, and this is something that when we interact with tribes, something that's very important from their perspective and something important for us to recognize is that the treaties are a reservation of rights. It's not a granting of rights. It wasn't like tribes started to hunt and fish in 1855. It's something, an activity that tribes have been doing since time immemorial. It's I think that, you know, one way of looking at it is essentially it could be considered almost a property right. Here they ceded land back to the United States, and they retained rights that occurred on that particular parcel, that land. So let's shift gears for a moment and just talk about tribal governments in Washington. There are 29 federally recognized tribes within the state. 21 of those are treaty tribes, so tribes that were recognized by the government during the signing of the treaties. Several others were executive order tribes. So, for instance, the Colville Confederated Tribes or the Spokane Tribe, the Chehalis Tribe, are all received their authority through a presidential order. And then finally, there was tribes that have become more recently federally recognized as they've made an appeal to Congress, and Congress has gone back and federally recognized that those tribes. All of all but one executive order tribe does not have off-reservation hunting and fishing rights. The Colville Confederated Tribe tribes have off-reservation rights in the former north half of their reservation. The other more recently federally recognized tribes also do not have off-reservation hunting and fishing rights. There's also a series of tribes that are trying to get federal recognition, so just wanted to acknowledge that that's underway. So there could be others that are added in the future, depending on when Congress takes those issues on. But in summary, when we're for the kind of the scope of this presentation, what I really wanted to focus is that we interact with 24 tribes that have off-reservation rights, hunting rights within Washington. And I had a typo. I said that there was three tribes on your handouts, and it is two. It's just the Nez Perce in Idaho and the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation in northeastern Oregon that have ceded territory in Washington State. Another item I just wanted to acknowledge that within tribal governments, you know, generally there's the tribal council, there's the general council, which is essentially, depending on the tribe, but essentially the voting populace of the tribe. Many of the tribes have natural resource departments, whether it's for forestry, fisheries management, wildlife management, and they have natural resource enforcement officers. Sometimes it might be on just the general on-reservation police unit, and sometimes it might be officers that are housed within the natural resources department. But there's also a couple different consortiums of tribes that I wanted to acknowledge as well. Northwest Indian Fish Commission, for instance, represents 20 Western Washington Treaty tribes. The Upper Columbia United Tribes in Northeast Washington represents some of the Northeast Washington executive order tribes and Idaho tribes. And then the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission represents those four tribes with Warm Springs, Nez Perce, Umatilla, and Yakima Nation. In addition, for instance, there's the Point No Point Treaty Council, which represents Jamestown and Port Gamble Sklallam tribe. So as you hear about the word tribe, it's not just this one bunch. There's individual government. Sometimes we're talking about working with the various consortiums. Sometimes we're talking about tribal rights in general. So I'm going to walk through three state Supreme Court cases, and I'm going to take them out of chronological order because I think that the key takeaway messages lend themselves a little bit nicer to kind of walking through and drilling into the scope of that privilege of hunting on open and unclaimed lands, that phrase in the Stevens Treaties. So the first case is that I'll walk through is State versus Miller. This was in 1984, where two members of the Skokomish tribe shot a cow elk in the Olympic National Forest outside of state seasons. And there's two primary takeaway messages from this case. The first is that the court ruled that there's not an operative distinction between the words right and privilege in construing Indian treaties. And secondly, this is where we talk about the conservation necessity standard. So the argument for this case was, well, the state seasons were closed. The tribal members were cited because they were hunting outside a state season. And so the state had argued that, well, it's a conservation value. Well, the court said, well, actually, you know, whether you shoot a cow elk in October or you shoot a cow elk in February outside a state season, it doesn't really matter from a biological perspective. And state, you're harvesting elk during this time. So it's not like it's a protected species, a listed species that the state is not condoning any hunting on, and then we'd be able to provide some sort of conservation concern. The fact that the state hunting indicates that the population is probably healthy enough to also continue to allow for tribal hunting. So this burden of proof is essentially that for a state regulation to apply to tribes, it needs to be reasonable and necessary for conservation. And the state has the burden of showing to the court that the application of state laws is necessary to preempt treaty regulation, essentially a kind of how would the state try to preempt a source of almost like federal law. And then shifting to 1999, walk through State versus Buchanan. And in this case, a member of the Nooksack tribe in Skagit River Valley harvested two bull elk at the Oak Creek Wildlife Area in the Natchez area. In this case, the court had ruled that a tribe's treaty hunting right, the off-reservation scope, extends to the ceded area that was designated in essentially Article 1 of the treaty. Here's the land that the tribe had ceded back to the United States. But the court also acknowledged that at the time, Native Americans didn't have a concrete property rights value that might be interpreted today. And so there was a lot of common use areas. And so the court recognized that tribes can use traditional areas. And so it might extend beyond the ceded area as long as it can be demonstrated that that area was used and occupied over an extended period of time. However, the court did not provide a method for which agency would interpret that. What's the threshold of level of evidence? What type of evidence would be considered? What if one tribe's traditional hunting area extends into another tribe's ceded area? So it kind of left us a lot of gray area there. And regarding Buchanan, as well as the next case, I'll walk through the Chambers case. Some tribes view kind of thanks, state Supreme Court, appreciate the guidance, but they still feel and hold that their off-reservation hunting rights extends to all open and unclaimed lands throughout the Washington Territory. So after the Buchanan decision came out in 1999, the department had developed a map, because now we had, and I tried to understand of where tribes that were signatory to the same treaty, where was their ceded area, and so this way we could coordinate in terms of setting wildlife management population objectives, understand from an enforcement consideration, et cetera. And so we had developed this map and sent this out to the tribes in about 2000, received some feedback. Some was, you know, there was a lot of frustration about the Supreme Court ruling, because the appellate court in the Buchanan decision had actually ruled that tribes could hunt throughout the Washington Territory. And so as the Supreme Court reversed that decision, it narrowed the geographic scope. We heard some feedback from tribes about, well, here we mapped a particular boundary wrong, you know, move it over 5 miles here, 10 miles here, make those necessary adjustments. And so those were done. And I'll walk through an agreement that we mediated a determination of the southern boundary of the Medicine Creek Treaty here shortly. The third and final state Supreme Court case I'll walk through was in 1973 called State versus Chambers. And in this case, an unlicensed Yakima tribal member had harvested a deer on private fenced property. The property was not signed, and it was a short distance from an unoccupied house. And here the court tried to interpret the phrase open and unclaimed. They indicated that, well, private land is not open and unclaimed, but private land would need to have some sort of indications of ownership. So whether it's the field's been plowed, there's fencing, there's signage, there's a house or a barn on the property, some way to know that, okay, well, they're about to cross onto private land. This would be where their treaty right would not extend to. And this language was included, again, in the Stevens Treaty to try to prevent conflict with settlers. And so this was an area that there was recognized that no one on private land, the treaty right would not extend to those parcels. But further, we try to look at, okay, well then, if we understand what private land is, then what about what types of land can be considered as public land in this definition of open and unclaimed lands? And in general, as public lands that are being managed in a way that's consistent with hunting is considered eligible for treaty hunting. So, for instance, Forest Service ground, BLM, the Department of Fish and Wildlife areas, but national parks, certain university lands, Washington State parks, in some cases military reservations, in some places on military reservations they do allow hunting, and tribes can hunt on those parcels. So that's kind of a mixed bag. But and there was a federal court case, U.S. v. Hicks, regarding whether or not tribal hunting rights extended onto federal national parks, and the court had ruled no, that the parks are not eligible for treaty hunting. So that's one federal court case that applies to treaty hunting. Shifting to how the department interacts with tribes, there's a couple commission policies that have provided guidance to the department. In 1996, shortly after merger, there was a policy document titled Policy Document. And Section 6 described the role of the commission, Section 8 described the role of the director, and acknowledging the department's going to maintain a cooperative management relationship with tribes, and that the director would negotiate management agreements with tribes consistent with federal court mandates. And of course, this was applying to both hunting and fishing in terms of relationships with tribes. In 1998, the Fish and Wildlife Commission adopted a policy specific to tribal hunting. And in 1998, this was actually when we had state appellate court had ruled in Buchanan that tribes could hunt throughout the Washington Territory. So here we have a scenario where there's 23 treaty tribes that could hunt throughout throughout Washington. And so how is it that we were going to manage this scenario where, so we don't have a tragedy of the commons? And so that policy acknowledges and respects tribal sovereignty. There's recognition of the overlapping jurisdiction that creates this co-management relationship, and the department's committed to working with tribes for the preservation of healthy wildlife populations. So after Buchanan came out in 99, the department started working in particular with the 20 Western Washington Treaty Tribes that are part of the Northwest Indian Fish Commission to develop a comprehensive hunting management agreement. And that agreement, the department and the tribes would get together on an annual basis, and after 6-plus years, we were never able to get that agreement quite across the finish line. There's 21 governments negotiating that agreement. So you can imagine the challenges that occurred there. We did during that time, I'd mentioned the Medicine Creek boundary, where when we sent out the map of our interpretation of the ceded area for the Treaty of Medicine Creek, those four tribes indicated, well, that's not the way we interpret it. They thought it went much further south. And so the department and those four tribes entered a mediated process where each side, if you will, hired an expert, allowed them to get together, each side presented evidence, and said whatever determination they come up with, that's what we'll use. And in fact, that southern boundary was adopted into WAC, and the tribes adopted that southern boundary in their hunting code. In 2006, the department decided, late 2006, we decided we needed to come up with a different approach. Working with the 20 tribes on one comprehensive agreement was probably too challenging. We were seeing a lot of tribal hunting areas of conflict, and we were wanting to try to get reach firmer agreements with tribes. And so we decided to pursue a regional approach. And so we were working with tribes that were all signatory to the same treaty. We were going around the state and trying to work with those groups of tribes. At that same time, in Game Management Unit 418, we and the Treaty of Point Elliott tribes had rested the North Cascades elk herd for 10 plus years. We had worked on a partnership of bringing elk from Mount St. Helens up to the Skagit Valley to try to rebuild that population. And we had agreed upon what would be some demographic measures for that herd that we'd both want to see before any side resumed harvest. And it was in 2006, 2007, where we first saw the surveys where we could resume some very limited bull hunts. And so that, I think, also really helped that biological reason, the motivation for the tribes and the state to resume harvest, coupled with the approach of wanting to go on, let's not try to negotiate an agreement with 20 governments. Let's work with the 9 tribes that are signatory to the Treaty of Point Elliott and get more focused. Instead of all wildlife for all areas, let's get focused. It was for elk and Game Management Unit 418. And so we secured an agreement in 2007 to initiate harvest there. That next year, the Point Elliott Agreement expanded to all hunted wildlife species throughout the Point Elliott ceded area, which generally lines up with our administrative region 4. And so that agreement has been renewed every year since. It has, we've had some years, 7 of 9 tribes have signed, 8 of 9 tribes have signed, and that's currently where we've been at, is all the tribes in the Treaty of Point Elliott have signed on, except for the Nooksack tribe. In general, these regional hunting agreements outline a geographic scope, so we kind of know here's the size of the universe that we're all working together on. The parties commit to sharing season regulations, share harvest information. We try to get together, have our technical staff get together to decide and agree upon everything from research projects to funding population surveys to what is the population objective. Do we have joint agreement on our current status? Do we have agreement on what's the harvestable surplus? Do we have agreement on how we're going to share that harvest? A lot of work occurs at this level, and I'd like to characterize that. We have, this is a lot of common ground with tribes as far as commitment on managing wildlife appropriately. That our technical staff, I think, overall get together often, and there's pretty good communication, and that occurs kind of throughout the state. The agreements in Western Washington also have a provision for regarding private industrial timberlands. And so if you think back on the Chambers case, where it was, well, if it's private land, that's very clearly has indications that it's in private ownership, well, that would not be eligible for treaty hunting. But what about large blocks of private industrial timberland, especially in a checkerboard ownership where it could be DNR and a private company land, and you would not be able to tell whether you were on private industrial timberland or not? And so we've included some language in the regional agreement, starting with the Point Elliott agreement, that essentially if the landowner is providing access to both state hunters and is willing to provide access to tribal hunters, the parcels are over 640 acres in size and a couple other conditions, that seems like that for the purpose of the agreement and other aspects of the agreement are being fulfilled. There's harvest reporting, there's reg sharing, that those lands would be eligible for treaty hunting for the purpose of the agreement. And the agreement has the appropriate reservations of the tribes would feel, hey, that's it's an area that's not in conflict with settlers. The landowner is providing permission. From the state's perspective, it's saying, well, that is private land. We've had some mixed signals from lower court rulings in Clallam County and Cowlitz County on whether or not private industrial timberlands and how they fit into that phrase, open and unclaimed lands. And so it seemed like, well, this is an area where tribes are needing access to a resource. We're having agreement on a variety of other aspects, and this was a part of the agreement that was included, and I think really, really helped bring the tribes together, in particular for the Treaty of Point Elliott. Also, in the hunting agreements, we have an enforcement section. And here it involves three different items. One is a commitment to try to do joint patrols. But we also spell out, for instance, what each, whether the state or the tribe's enforcement officers, what happens when a contact is made or a violation is observed. So, for instance, a state enforcement officer encounters a tribal member on open and unclaimed lands that is a time, place, and manner violation of the tribe's hunting regulations. That's not something that our state Fish and Wildlife officers have the authority to enforce. And so that's something where we would offer essentially to become an expert witness, relay that information back to the to their counterparts in the tribe's natural resources enforcement agency. So those are the types of scenarios and contacts that we try to flesh out in the enforcement section. And just in the past couple, 3 years, we've included language for tribes to participate in damage hunts. So damage statutes were amended by the legislature in 2009. The commission adopted rules in 2010 that talked about wildlife conflict. And in one of those rules, there is acknowledgement that where the department has a hunting agreement with the tribe, that tribes could participate in department-managed damage hunts. And so we have a provision in some of our agreements about how that coordination would work. It's important for the state to be the one that continues to primarily work with the landowner so that, I mean, sometimes tags are offered in lieu of damage claims. So, or that there's other preventative measures that we're wanting to work with to try to alleviate that issue becoming a chronic problem. But where we have agreements, previously, we would, when enforcement would manage wildlife conflict, we would try to reserve some of the damage permits to tribes, but the tribes had to purchase state hunting licenses to participate. And so this WAC change allowed that. No, when we're doing this as a cooperative management approach, here's an area where these elk are trying to be removed. The tribes are cooperative managers here and are able to participate and help us with that, with just that removal of an animal off of private land. I mentioned for current agreements that we had in 2013, the Point Elliott Agreement. We have an agreement with the Skokomish Indian Tribe. That agreement we've had for, 2012 and 2013. Just this fall, we signed an agreement with the Jamestown and Port Gamble Sklallam Tribes. We also signed an agreement this fall with the Lower Elwha Tribe. We have an agreement going back to 1998 with the Colville Confederated Tribes. Again, as I mentioned, they're an executive order tribe. They have off-reservation hunting rights in the former north half of their Indian reservation, which is like GMUs 101, 105, and 204. And that off-reservation hunting right and fishing right actually went to the U.S. Supreme Court in the 70s. And so the relationship between the state and the Colvilles is pretty clear. And this agreement in 1998 requires an annual meeting of policy, enforcement, and wildlife management staff. And I think I would characterize this relationship as extremely positive. We've really interact and work very well with a number of at multiple levels within the Colville Confederated Tribes on hunting issues. We have an agreement with the Cowlitz Tribe. They're a federally recognized tribe. They do not have off-reservation hunting and fishing rights, but this was an acknowledgement of a government-to-government relationship and sharing of information about wildlife resources, et cetera, that the Cowlitz Tribe has been engaged in. They've been a very active partner in a number of different fisheries and wildlife management activities, in particular on wildlife species with the recovery of the federally and state-listed Columbian white-tailed deer. And I've already walked through the Medicine Creek southern boundary determination. We also have two agreements between the department and tribes regarding specifically an enforcement of hunting or public safety violations. So, for instance, in a lot of our agreements, we talk about, well, here's what we do for just kind of straightforward time, place, and manner violations. But what about those that are public safety violations that occurred in the act of hunting? So hunting while intoxicated, shooting across the roadway, failure to wear hunter orange, et cetera. The Colville Confederated Tribes had sued us in federal court, and as part of the settlement agreement, we negotiated an agreement about how we were going to handle those types of contacts. And really, it was looking at both the state code and the tribal code and coming up with a deferral agreement to refer a prosecution of violations or investigation of violations back to the tribe. And we did a similar review with the Skokomish Indian Tribe and have an enforcement agreement with them. So, again, going back to about the year 2000 and trying to implement Buchanan, we had a couple tribes approach us with asserting the traditional hunting area. So again, this was an area that was used and occupied over an extended period of time that may extend beyond a tribe's ceded area. And those were the Macaw Tribe and the Quinault Tribe. And we came up with a one-page memorandum agreements. They were annual agreements that essentially looked at their fishing usual and accustomed area and said, you know, it's probably pretty reasonable if they had a salmon camp, for instance, in Macaw, we're down towards Tongue Point on the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and deer were behind their camp. They likely hunted it, so let's use that as rough guidance on how to interpret this. And so we did a similar agreement using the adjudicated UNAs for Quinault as well to apply for a hunting agreement consistent with implementing Buchanan. But it was about 2007, 2008 where we were approached essentially simultaneously, or we were having enforcement contacts with tribal members outside of the ceded area, and we knew we needed to kind of pause and take a look at how it is that we're going to assess and be consistent with how we approach tribes that are asserting traditional hunting areas. And so we had developed some draft procedural guidelines that summer of 2009, and those had, while they have not been completed, they still are the kind of the rough guidance that the department uses today. And essentially, when we learn of a tribe that's asserting a traditional hunting area, the department requests evidence from the asserting tribe. But what types of information, and this is information from 15, 20 years ago, but going back to 1855, what type of information did you have that could help demonstrate that used and occupied over an extended period of time? We then oftentimes will invite county prosecutors to meet with us while the tribes, the asserting tribe is sharing that evidence. We want to have discussions with affected tribes, because often if there's not conflict between one tribe's assertion into another tribe's ceded area, then great. We just want to know where the tribes are wanting to hunt so that we understand from an enforcement perspective as well as for coordination of wildlife management. So that could be a huge help with us if we knew that there was alignment with tribes on their understanding of each other's traditional hunting area. And of course, as a state, we do not have the authority to interpret or necessarily adjudicate a tribe's off-reservation hunting right. So at the end of these discussions, what we do is essentially we're providing enforcement discretion. We're looking at the preponderance of evidence of whether or not an asserting tribe used and occupied that area over an extended period of time. And that type of information could be everything from elder testimony to anthropological, ethnographic reports, Indian claims commissions, journals from settlers or railroad surveys. I mean, it's quite fascinating when you kind of dig in and try to look for information 150 years ago that described where the different tribes were accessing and utilizing resources in different areas. But we just look at that information, the preponderance of the evidence, and essentially provide enforcement discretion, as well as provide counsel to our wildlife biologists and saying, okay, well, here's an area now that we'll want to coordinate on population surveys or research projects. In a couple instances, we actually have included that agreed upon area in a formal agreement with the department, but oftentimes it's a enforcement discretion. And each year, I kind of go through the list of where we've had assessments of tribes' traditional hunting area information and summarize that for the appropriate staff. So we just kind of get the word out about here's what the current state of affairs is in terms of the relationship of understanding traditional hunting areas. As I mentioned, in about 2006, 2007, a number of tribes started to come forward, and that's continued to play out. I'll just kind of briefly walk through, and if you can follow the arrow, the Macaws Treaty ceded area is essentially the HOCO GMU. They asserted a fair amount of area along the straits and further south into the Solduck GMU down along kind of towards La Push. After reviewing that information, we're providing guidance about where, if you draw a line on their southern boundary of their UNA across to the park, and then that the Pish GMU along the straits, roughly matched up with what we saw. It wasn't quite as much territory as the macaws asserted, but again, looking at the preponderance of evidence that was provided, this seems something reasonable. And consulting with the county prosecutors, there was an agreement on that's where we would apply enforcement discretion. Similar with Quinault, really looking at the portion of Quinault Ridge, portion of Copalis, and the Wainuchi GMU that's outside of their ceded area. The Suquamish tribe asserted a fair amount of area along the Olympic Peninsula. After reviewing their information, we acknowledged there was some area essentially kind of east of 101. This is an area that there's still a dispute with the Suquamish tribe about how much area that they feel is part of their treaty right, but that's the enforcement guidance that we've been providing. The Muckleshoot Indian tribe asserted, of course, they're signatory to both the Treaty of Point Elliott and the Treaty of Medicine Creek. They asserted traditional hunting east of the Cascade Crest. We worked with them quite a bit over probably a year, 2 year process, and we acknowledged there was a preponderance of evidence that they traditionally hunted in about 10 GMUs east of the Cascade Crest. The Skokomish tribe asserted that they traditionally hunted in this portion outside of the Point No Point ceded area, and that was included within our agreement with Skokes. The Upper Skagit tribe asserted that they hunted east of the Cascade Crest along a number of GMUs. After reviewing their evidence and consultation with the Yakima Nation, we provided guidance back. Well, there was probably a couple GMUs along that northern border of the just east of the Cascades and along the Canadian border that we felt met that preponderance of evidence standard. The Upper Skagit has continued to assert other areas. We have discussions coming up with the Umatilla tribe hunting outside their ceded area along the Columbia River, probably, you know, in line with a lot of their fishing areas and all the way through to Skamania County. And then just this fall, we had a regional agreement with signed with the two Tusculum tribes and the Lower Elwha Klallam tribe. And Port Gamble and Jamestown asserted areas just outside the Point No Point ceded area in these two GMUs, and Lower Elwha asserted those areas as well as in the HOCO GMU. And after looking at the preponderance of evidence that they had shared, that was something that we included in the agreement that we signed this past December. Having said all this, there's certainly, I don't want to leave the impression that there's peace in the valley in terms of how other tribes are viewing these ceded areas. The fact that tribes asserted areas, the state or the department recognized a portion of their asserted area, maybe didn't get all the area that they felt that they wanted us to apply enforcement discretion, but it's been a start to a pretty complex area of law for us. To kind of head towards wrapping up here, I did want to acknowledge that about a year ago, the Skokomish Indian tribe sued a number of officials, both on the commission, Director Anderson, Chief Bjork, the Commissioner of Public Lands, and a number of county prosecutors, alleging violations or infringement on the Point No Point hunting right. The state defendants had submitted a motion to the federal court to dismiss the case. The judge had granted that motion on several counts, not on all the suite of items that were raised. The tribe did not submit another brief back to the judge, but instead appealed that judge's motion to dismiss to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and so that's where the current status of that legal proceeding rests. So it's going to be a while as we continue to kind of work through the initial legal proceedings before we even know if we're going to get to the merits of the case. And then two other areas that I didn't walk through today, but just wanted to acknowledge that we spend a fair amount of time on is we do work with tribes on providing on-reservation hunting opportunities, whether it's small game hunting on Colville or small game hunting on Yakima Indian Reservation. There's some bear hunts that occur on Quinault and waterfowl hunting throughout some of the Puget Sound tribes area. So there's coordination there for non-Indian opportunity, as well as an area that's always a kind of another topic is non-Indians that are participating in tribal hunts, and so and just very briefly, non-Indians you have to be a member of the tribe that has promulgated a hunting regulation that has that off-reservation right, but there is ability for, if there's overlapping seasons, for a state hunter to be in the truck with a tribal hunter or a non-Indian hunter in camp with a tribal hunter, et cetera. It can't actually participate in the act of hunting. The way we've I mean, when you think about the coordination from an enforcement, wildlife management, policy perspective, and with 24 different governments, and then the consortiums of some of those tribes, it takes a fair amount of effort on our end. It's very important to maintain positive working relationships with tribes. Our team generally is made up of the regional director, the captain, and a regional wildlife program manager, who are doing the bulk of kind of the day-to-day coordination with tribes. And then at the headquarters level, Director Anderson, the Chief Crown, Deputy Chief Hobbs and Sensi, myself and Greg, and then the attorneys with the Attorney General's office kind of round out the policy team addressing tribal hunting issues within the department. Be happy to take any questions.
That was a wonderful summary. Terrific job, Nate.
Thanks.
Any questions? Director Anderson, do you want to say something
first? Thanks, Madam Chair. Just wanted to add just a couple of additional details. The slide that Nate put up with the list of tribes where we had discussions on traditional area was a list of the tribes that have approached us asserting traditional area that extended beyond their ceded area boundaries as we had described in the map that we sent out in the year 2000. And he certainly did acknowledge that there wasn't agreement across the tribal landscape with respect to those agreements. And in several cases, there's been strenuous objection to the agreements that we entered into. One of those is with the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe relative to those GMUs that are on the east crest of the Cascades, the Yakima Indian Nation has raised serious concern and objection to the Muckleshoot's assertion that their traditional areas extend east of the Cascade Crest. I went over and met with the Yakima Tribal Council some time ago about that matter. It remains unresolved. And as you well know, the Quileute Tribe has expressed serious objection to the agreements that we entered into with Port Gamble, Jamestown, and Lower Elwha. I know they came before the commission, and there's several of the members from the Quileute Tribe here today, expressed their serious objections to those agreements. And we did have an opportunity, I had an opportunity along with staff and representatives from the Attorney General's office to meet with the Quileute Tribe here just a short time ago. Was just prior to the more intense part of North Falcon here, so it's a little bit of a, it seems like a long time ago, but it wasn't that, I think it was last week, April 3rd, or I believe Thursday, I think. And the Quileute Tribe was gracious enough to bring the majority of their tribal council and provided us their information and analysis that supported their perspective, and so we are going to have continuing discussions with them as well as with Port Gamble, Jamestown, and Lower Elwha. And most of these, not all, but most of these agreements are one-year agreements that coincide with the hunting year, so in general from August 1 through July, and that is the case with the Port Gamble, Jamestown, Lower Elwha. And as a result of the conversation we had with Quileute, I'm approaching those three tribes to discuss the status of those agreements. Their hunting seasons have closed. Nevertheless, wanted to have a conversation with those as a follow-up to my meeting with Quileute Tribe on that matter. The Skokomish Tribe has also been concerned that the southern portion of the Point No Point ceded area is an exclusive area to the Skokomish Tribe, and so they were concerned about the agreements we entered into with the three, with the two Esklallam and the one Klallam tribe as well. So, and we also have encountered a Yakima tribal member hunting in the far northeastern portion of the state. That is something that we're looking at, both with the county where it occurred as well as the Attorney General's office on that that particular contact over in that area. So there's a number of these that, and I would also say that while we haven't renewed in writing our agreement with the Macaw in recent years, we've exercised that enforcement discretion consistent with that agreement since that time, as we have with the Quinault Indian Nation in the area of Wainuchi Valley, and so there's a couple of those pieces as well. So as this has obviously been a very difficult issue for the Department of Fish and Wildlife to wade through, and I'm sure that our conversations with the tribes will continue on an ongoing basis. There have been some really good benefits associated with entering into the agreements with the tribes that include the sharing of data and the cooperative wildlife management approach that are identified in those agreements. The enforcement referral pieces associated with the public safety. There's six different public safety pieces that we've incorporated in agreements with the Skokomish. And the Point Elliott tribes that is kind of patterned after the one we did with the Colville tribe originally. So there are some really positive benefits, and these agreements go far beyond just the geographic scope question. They go into how are we going to cooperatively manage wildlife, share data, and coordinate from an enforcement perspective. So a lot of issues associated with this topic, and we'll continue to learn and work our way through these issues, hopefully in a successful way.
Thank you. I know we've talked about the Quileute concerns with the point-no-point agreements. Director Anderson, do you want to give us a little bit more about the sharing of information that we've received about their harvest? I think you've provided me with some information about the harvest numbers you're getting from the tribes.
If you're speaking, this is relative to the Port Gamble, Jamestown, Lower Elwha, okay, that you're speaking in terms of harvest data sharing,
yeah,
which was a part of the critical part of our agreement, and a. Did share their data by GMU. I saw a summary of their harvest in the early part of February, which was prior to the completion of all the seasons that were a part of those agreements. I'm assuming there's been some updates to those since then. I don't have those numbers off the top of my head.
Yeah, and I wasn't expecting to have those numbers, but just the mere fact that we're starting to get
them. We also had an incident where one of the tribal members was hunting outside the area that was agreed to. That incident was referred back to the tribe. And while I haven't followed up in the last 6 weeks or so, the tribe took that infraction very seriously and prosecuted that individual through tribal court.
And the information that we're gathering, are those pieces of information being shared with the other affected tribes? Would we, if asked?
The harvest data, certainly. I'd be happy to, you know, we're happy to do that. The information in many cases from all the tribes goes into a central point within the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission. That information, as it's shared with us, is not on a tribe-by-tribe basis, but on a GMU-by-GMU basis, and obviously species, and if it's if there's a need to differentiate between buck and doe and cow and bull, those are indicated in that data. But I would add that we have... we've encouraged and will continue to do so in cases where there's disagreement on aspects of particularly the geographic scope as well as the regulations that are in place for each GMU, that we have better communication and coordination between the tribes, and so that there's a sharing of data between the tribes where they are, if they are hunting in common in a particular GMU, and or preferably in the preseason planning process where we have that type of coordination. Mm-hmm. We're a ways away from that, I think, but I believe there's a willingness, I believe, I can't guarantee it, a willingness to have those conversations as we go through the spring here. We obviously don't want this kind of a repeat of the situation that we have right now with respect to the point-no-point treaty, the three point-no-point treaty tribes and the Quileute tribe. So we're going to work hard with them and as well as encourage them to communicate amongst themselves so that we can get a resolution to this particular issue.
Okay. Thank you. I was going to ask you about that, how things stand now in terms of the tribes that are in conflict in that area coming together. Is there a commitment now? Because it sounded like they were not speaking with each other.
Well, I don't want to speak for any of them. I it is my understanding that they have had some discussions, what plans they have. I think there's an interest in doing that, but I don't want to speak out of turn or on behalf of any one of the four tribes involved there as to what kind of communications they're trying to establish, but we're hopeful that they will.
Great. Thank you. Commissioner Kehoe. Yes.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Nate, thanks for the presentation. I know a lot more than I used to know about the tribal hunting issues that the department handles. So I have a question about, you mentioned the discussions with in agreements concerning traditional hunting area, the process where you meet and consider evidence and then come up with a determination. Is there a process or a policy in place where you share this information in terms of agreements and the rationale with Washington citizens? I mean, kind of on a periodic basis, and just so that, hunters in certain communities understand or know that, that they're not surprised if they see tribal hunters in their backyard.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Kehoe, say it's done in a couple different ways. First off, we have a tab under our hunting page that's devoted to tribal hunting, and we've just recently kind of took a fresh look at that. That material was getting a little bit stale, and we put all the hunting agreements, the formal hunting agreements that we have with tribes online. So a number of the areas where there is a written agreement in terms of enforcement discretion regarding traditional hunting areas, that's available. We have a segment in our pamphlet that talks about off-reservation hunting rights. We don't go into the details necessarily of each agreement or which GMUs a particular tribe might be traditionally hunting in, because, I mean, we're also not going through the entire ceded area in which GMUs that a tribe's hunting in. We've included similar language within our hunter education manual, just to provide a primer and tribal hunting overview to expose Washington hunters about recognizing that tribes are in Washington. They're able to hunt with time, place, and manner, talk about some of the authorities that they have, explain that, you know, it doesn't necessarily align with state seasons. I mean, it could be that someone's out with a modern firearm during a state archery deer season, and explain how that's legal to do so. So, and then certainly, I mean, I've come to the commission probably every couple years on a tribal hunting overview and share the status of where we're at with different agreements. And so I would take credit for this briefing in terms of making this information available to the public.
No, that's good. I think, you know, you don't want to have a situation where people think that the department is making these backroom deals and that's not the case, obviously. So,
Director Anderson.
I think there's one other point to make here, and you may have already got it, but maybe bears worth repeating. There's a couple of important elements here, maybe three. Well, one is wildlife management, wildlife conservation. The state and the tribes are all promulgating regulations, ordinances that allow hunting in certain areas. We have a lot of concern collectively that together our regulations will not result in an overharvest or stressing the populations of game. So to the extent the benefit of coordinating and entering into agreements that include that element is an extremely important one. The other one is, obviously, there's a lot of difference in the amount of privately owned land today than there was in 1855. And this issue about open and unclaimed, does permission change the status of the land? The couple of cases that Nate referenced, having an understanding about where state law will be applied and where it is preempted by the treaty right is an important understanding to have in that regard, so that when tribal members are out hunting pursuant to their tribe's regulations, they have a level of certainty about what to expect if contacted by a state enforcement officer. And then that same element, that same issue is captured in the geographic scope element of these agreements. Because the question, as Nate said, we're not in a position to determine where the geographic extent of the treaty right is in any specific way. From a state law perspective, we are, and through the state Supreme Court, we know that it extends to the ceded areas. We've attempted to have a map that has those boundaries on it, that has some level of tentative agreement relative to the ceded area. And then there's this question about traditional area and the fact that the hunting right of any particular tribe may extend beyond the ceded area into an area that is characterized as traditional area. And again, in that kind of a circumstance, we want to be able to provide our enforcement officers a level of certainty about where state law applies and where it is preempted by a treaty right, just the same as the tribal hunters that are out there hunting pursuant to their treaty right want to have certainty as to what they can expect from our law enforcement officers if contacted, knowing that if they're hunting in a particular area, they're doing so based on their treaty right, and therefore state law as it pertains to hunting regulations is preempted. And we also want to make sure that we're coordinating with the county prosecutors, because at the end of the day, if we're citing an individual and that case goes to the county prosecutor and we have a sense of what the evidence will be relative to the geographic area as it pertains to the treaty right, we want to have a level of assurance, as well as the county prosecutors want to have a level of assurance that if we forward that case to them, that state law indeed does apply in that case or not. And so the geographic scope question isn't a matter of us trying to figure out or determine what it is. It is a matter, however, of where state law applies and or where enforcement discretion needs to be exercised because of a preponderance of the evidence suggesting that activity is being conducted relative to a treaty right and therefore preempt state law. So those are the kinds of key elements that are in these agreements, or the majority of these agreements. They're the key elements that we believe bring about a level of certainty relative to the tribal hunting activities, as well as bring about certainty in terms of wildlife conservation and management, that all of the governmental entities that are promulgating regulations or ordinances are done in a coordinated manner that ensures the perpetuation of the wildlife species in question. So,
nicely stated. Anything else? Any other questions for Nate or comments? Very good job. Thank you so much.